Good morning.
Let's get it adjusted, Your Honor.
Sure.
May it please the court, my name is David Wedby, along with Tim Ford. I represent the plaintiffs and appellants in this matter, Annalisa and Frederick Thomas. This case boils down
to reserve any time?
Three minutes, Your Honor. This case now before this court boils down to whether this court could factually distinguish the case in Lindstrom v. Ladenburg, which announced the rule that factual statements or other tangible evidence gathered by the prosecutor or his or her representative in anticipation of litigation is work product. And I would submit to this court that there are two ways that the facts are different from our case versus that case. In this case, we had the unusual situation where the Pierce County's investigator, Keith Barnes, accessed the police reports in question, and I'll quickly say that there are two sets of police reports, one from essentially the city of Lakewood, which we know now were 16 reports, and another batch of reports which were assembled by Fife and its lead detective, Thomas Gow. So with respect to the Lakewood reports, those were essentially shared files uploaded onto the what's called the RMS system at South Sound 911, and then could be accessed by not only Mr. Barnes, but also any other of the participant agencies. So here what we had is police reports that reflected an already completed investigation, independent of any litigation plans that the Pierce County prosecution had with respect to the charging decision of Officer Markert. So we had records that were created in the ordinary course of business, unrelated to the litigation, available on the RMS system for not only Mr. Barnes to see, but also anybody else. When we requested those records, it may be true that Mr. Barnes downloaded the records in his deposition. He said that he downloaded them all into the prosecutor's files, but those records continued to exist and were accessible to the prosecutor's office to be produced in response to a public records request at the same time. So I think that's the first factual distinction. The second one was that by the time the...
Are you focusing on the moment in time before the charging decision was announced? Are you trying to say that that was a violation?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
We are concentrating on...
Later. All right.
And let me ask you this. The trial court determined that because of the remedial, I guess, effect of the PRA, it should construe that October 3 letter as a request. But the case law says that one of the few burdens that a requester has is to state the request with sufficient clarity to give the agency fair notice that it had received a request for a public record. And your letter of October 3rd tells the prosecutor's office that you're seeking an answer as to whether or not they are going to release any documents pursuant to our August 6, 2013 request. Isn't a fair reading of that on October 3rd, you gave, with sufficient clarity, the agency notice that it had received a request on August 6th?
I can see that the request is ambiguous.
Where's the ambiguity? Pursuant to our August 6, 2013 request, what's ambiguous about that?
Because the request goes on to say whether the county's response is still in effect. And what's that alerts the county to the fact that there's been a significant change in circumstance. And because there can be no standing requests under the PRA, we were asking anew whether that request still had force. In our view, that could be a renewed request, and I think the trial court, in its finding of fact, did not create, there was no manifest unreasonableness to the reading that was a new request.
And is there a case that talks about this particular issue in terms of the clarity of a request that helps you with your argument there?
The case that helps us with our argument, Your Honor, is that any lack of clarity doesn't go to liability, but rather it goes to whether the trial court would impose penalties. That's the first Yusufian mitigating factor, is the lack of clarity in a request. So I think
is that lack of clarity about what you're asking for or about whether you've asked for something?
I would say either, Your Honor.
Is that what was an issue in Yusufian?
I can't tell you off the top of my head.
Because when I read that letter, it struck me as, now that a charging decision has been made, we'd like you to reconsider your response to our August request.
That's exactly what the effect of, that was the intent of the request, and I believe that that's sufficient to ask again to reconsider making it a new, just the same as a new request.
In the Koenig opinion from this court, the issue was phrased like this. The question here is whether the prosecutor's office committed a Public Records Act violation by deciding to follow the civil discovery rule in reliance on the plurality opinion in Lindstrom. Isn't that the same question as here?
That is the same question, yes, Your Honor.
So the focus is not on what this court thinks that Lindstrom means. The focus is on the reasonableness of the prosecutor's office determination to follow the Lindstrom opinion, right?
Ultimately, the question would be whether
a lawyer can lose a case and still make a reasonable argument. That happens all of the time.
That's
it's
true.
It's probably going to happen six times today. Since we only heard six cases, right? And none are frivolous or sanctionable. So the focus is on the responder, the prosecutor's office, whether their reliance on the plurality opinion in Lindstrom is reasonable, right?
You can answer.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think that an agency simply has to make a good faith interpretation of the statute or a precedent interpreting that statute, and if it's simply good faith, that means there's no PRA liability. I mean, that would be true, for instance, if we were in the inmate context where there's a bad faith showing. But I think that if the agency is ultimately wrong in how it responded to a PRA request, then it still can incur liability. It could be that the trial court would not pose any penalties ultimately on remand because they made a good faith reliance on existing precedent.
You've given a sufficient answer. You can take it up
again.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dan Hamilton. I represent Pierce County in this matter. Your Honors, the trial court dismissed plaintiff's suit because the Supreme Court in Lindstrom and this court in Koenig both held that reports created by police in the ordinary course of their business and later gathered by prosecutors in anticipation of litigation cannot be compelled also from the prosecutor because they are protected as ordinary work product in the prosecutor's hands. Now, plaintiff's reply brief makes a gross mischaracterization of the county's position and the facts and the issue by arguing that the county, quote, takes a shocking position that the people must yield to it and never be able to look at otherwise public documents from which it decided the killing was justified, end quote. Your Honors, CP, the clerk's papers 152, shows the facts are to the contrary, and the plaintiffs long ago were able to look at reports from the police before the prosecutor's charging decision and obtained even more afterwards. Plaintiffs make reference to the city of Fife. When you look at specifically at 152, it shows that each of these cities, including the South Sound 911, who assembles all of these reports, responded after the charging decision was made. So
the version that's accessible to everybody was provided by the entity that maintains the accessibility.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
South Sound 911
yes.
maintains some set of records electronically that are accessible by the involved agencies?
Each agency submits their reports to a central collector and who's responsible to maintain them as well.
The South Sound agency?
It is one of them, yes, Your Honor.
All right. And that agency responded by providing all of these records that counsel described as remaining accessible even after they were a copy was placed in the prosecutor's file?
They were obtained by the investigator for the prosecuting attorney's office by a request to the individual agencies and South Sound.
What I understood counsel to be saying is there really are two copies that's hanging out there. There's the copy that was downloaded to the prosecutor's office, and then there's this copy that all the rest of these agencies could still access. So we should have been able to get it, too.
Well, they
and
could.
It sounds like they did get it.
They did get it, yes, Your Honor. That's the one of the points in this, is that they did get it, and now really this lawsuit is not about getting those documents. It's about getting attorney's fees and penalties per day because they didn't also get the same documents from the prosecutor. And the question...
Could I ask you to address the issue of the second letter? I'm wondering if you have a take on what is the law about whether a second request is a new request or a renewal of an old request, and what difference does it make, and, you know, how do you tell, and so forth. Is that an issue on which the case law is unclear at the present time?
Well, I don't think the case law has never addressed it because an issue has never come where, as far as I know, at least on an appellate level, where the party's plaintiff has come in and said, don't look at what the face of the record says. The law will convert what the face of the letter says into a new request. There is no case law that says that, Your Honor, and the case law instead is that, you know, you have to make a reasonable request. It has to be understandable as a request. And here, as was pointed out, the letter was neither a second PRA request nor a renewal. It expressly said that it was to, quote, clarify or confirm, end quote, an earlier request, and it says the prosecutor's office that what they're trying to confirm is that, quote, the prosecutor's office will not release any documents pursuant to our August 6, 2013 request. So they're expressly limiting the request to say, hey, can you guys change your mind now about that earlier request? When we responded in our response saying, well, that we see this, no, we're not going to change our mind as to the earlier request, they didn't say, oh, no, we mean we made a new request. There is no present pending charges. You've already decided that. We're making a new one. That would be the time to say it
this
as well.
This is analogous to a motion for reconsideration in a courtroom.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
This letter is analogous to a motion for reconsideration in a courtroom.
I think that's one way of looking at it, Your Honor, but a reconsideration of an earlier case versus then later on claiming the law somehow ipso facto, hocus pocus, converts an earlier case into a whole new cause of action. Yes, Your Honor, I think that...
I've got a question about some of the things that you've cited to us about this. Because they're very persuasive, I'm just not sure if they matter.
Okay.
Their complaint, the requester did not set forth the August 3 letter as being a request, but rather treated the October 3 letter as being a request,
right.
Rather treated the earlier ones the request. And you sent a discovery request to them where you asked them to list all requests they'd made, and they did not list the October 3 request. And then I think you said something about when it was in the pleadings that they first claimed that this was a request. Don't we view whether it's a request from the standpoint of the requester at the time they received it? So as persuasive as all of those facts are as to what their state of mind might have been, it wasn't facts within your knowledge at that time on October 3?
Well, we didn't, we had no, I guess I'm missing the point of the question.
Well, you didn't know that they weren't going to name it in their complaint, and you didn't know that they weren't were going to answer their discovery request in that way, and you didn't know what their pleadings would say if they sued you. No, you just knew what they...
Sure, all we could do was look at what the letter said, and the letter seemed to, on its face, didn't seem to, it on its face said, hey, look at this other one. Have you changed your mind? And now on appeal, they're saying agreeing with that. They're having no problem with...
To get to Judge Starr's question, can we look at things you pointed out to us, or do we just have to look at the letter and not cite this later information because that information wasn't available to the person receiving the request at the time they made their decision? What determines what we get to look at to answer the question whether this was or wasn't a request?
Well, I think you look on the face of what existed at the time. Again, as the court, as the judge just mentioned, it really doesn't matter. But when you look at additional facts, it just makes it even stronger, more clear.
We get to look at those additional facts.
I think, Your Honor, it depends on what the issue is. Where the issue is, for instance, did they have the inability to obtain them elsewhere? Then the court can look at those other facts. When you get to the issue of, well, it's ordinary work.
The issue is this a request or not? Do we get to look to the later facts?
I think the court, I don't know what the law is on that, Your Honor, except to say that.
I could suggest that when we look at what the parties meant in a contract, we sometimes look at their subsequent behavior because it illustrates what they meant.
Well, I guess that's one way of looking at this. This isn't a contract, Your Honor. This is the Public Records Act request.
And well, I understand the request that. We're still looking to see what a document means.
Yes, fair enough. And you do it within the four corners unless there's some ambiguity under contract principles. And as was pointed out, there's nothing ambiguous about this request. And the law does not convert the Public Records Act. Nowhere says that it converts a request into something else because we...
Well, it doesn't really matter, does it? I mean, the thing is this is like a technical argument. It didn't, at the time, it didn't make any difference.
No, that's correct. At the time, it didn't make any difference.
I mean, right now, it's just an argument about why we shouldn't even have to think about the substance of it.
I think
it's a technical appellate argument.
One is a factual issue, I guess. They want to make it into a factual issue, and they lose on that one. And if they could overcome and say, well, it really was a request, then it becomes a legal issue of whether does this court overturn Lemstrom, does this court overturn its own decision in Koenig? You're right. The court doesn't need to get to that pretty audacious argument that this court is going to overturn Lemstrom and ignore its own decision on a case that is on all four corners of the facts here. You're right.
I think it takes less guts to overturn Lindstrom than it does to overturn Koenig since Judge Becker wrote it.
So well, that was my...
try that, but...
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
I have a question for you.
The court always has an open...
you're not allowed to distinguish amongst requesters.
Yes.
Okay. So how does that principle apply with regard to the principle that if they want something, if the requester wants something that they otherwise can't get because of the work product bar, that they have to come forward and show a special need? I mean, if this was an anonymous request, wouldn't they have to identify themselves in order to show a special need? And how does that fit together with the right to be anonymous, the government's responsibility not to distinguish between requesters?
The courts have said, the Supreme Court sort of said that any materials that would not be discoverable in the context of a controversy under the civil rules of pretrial discovery also are exempt under the Public Disclosure Act. It says the same test. The Public Records Act doesn't create a special work product protection. And this court in Koenig essentially almost expressly said that it defines the parameters of the work product rule for the purposes of applying the exemption. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Couple things to clear up, Your Honors. First of all, we did not obtain any significant records about what had happened here until well after what I'm calling the second request. And we still didn't receive the documents into the next year, in fact. So the fact that Mr. Hamilton makes the point that we had already gotten a lot of documents before August 6th or even October 3rd is not true.
But you're not making an issue here in this case of the slowness or incompetence of the agencies that didn't get around to giving you those documents.
Well, there's an indirect issue, Your Honor, and that would go to the, if we do go to the substantial need undue hardship test, that it would be, it's unduly hard to have to wait for the municipal police agencies that may take over a year, which is exactly what happened here, especially in the compelling situation where we have parents trying to figure out why their son had been killed by the police, and Pierce County doesn't.
Well, how does that fit in when they can't distinguish between requesters?
Well,
we got a series of head notes out there that everybody always points to, but they don't always line up.
I concede Your Honor's curiosity on this, that it's there's some incoherence, because and especially if you, no disrespect to the King decision, Your Honor, but I think that there was dicta in that decision that said that there needs to be a showing of substantial need and undue hardship, and I think the county wants to read that there needs to make a showing at the time of that the request is made, and I think that that implicitly grafts on an additional requirement to the PRA that the legislature didn't attend.
When do you think that showing is required?
Perhaps it could be required, Your Honor, when the county or the agency responds to the requester saying, we're asserting work product. If you would like to try and get this information, you may assert additional grounds to show substantial need and undue hardship. So at least the requester, who is not always a lawyer, obviously, has some idea about what they need to do in order to get the records that they might be entitled to under this ordinary work product protection. So in closing, it's no secret that we have a critique of the Lindstrom decision, and we believe it's inconsistent with the obligation under the PRA that statute be narrowly, the exceptions be narrowly construed, that it's inconsistent with the idea that evidentiary privileges should be narrowly construed. It's inconsistent with the idea that business records created in the ordinary course fall outside of work product altogether. And it's inconsistent with the FOIA jurisprudence that we mentioned in our brief, that Mendoza de Sugiyama says should be aligned with the PRA. And for all these reasons, we would ask that the court at the very least highlight some of these flaws so that we may have a better chance of presenting our arguments to the Supreme Court. But we do think that there are factual determinations that could allow this court to reverse the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. And our